Today, the Emperor has no clothes with Steve Van Meter. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics Work Knowledge Post, covering finance and proper news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Steve Van Meter, the Bond King from his throne room.
Hi, Martin. It's great to be back.
It's great to have you back on the show, and love the background there. It's terrific.
Yeah, thank you. I thought we should hang out in the throne room today, you know.
No, very good. Look, there's so much to talk about, but I'd like to start with Jackson Hole and the virtual speech that Powell gave last Friday, because I think a lot of people were expecting it to be a really big revelatory conversation, but it really wasn't, was it?
No, in fact, if you watch or listen to any of the FOMC press conferences, there really wasn't much more there. I mean, obviously it was longer and there was more detail, kind of giving us some insight in what kind of the Fed's view of inflation and employment, something we don't get quite that much detail normally. And so from that perspective, it was interesting. But as far as any major announcements or, you know, taper talk, it was just kind of the normal stuff, which I don't think obviously the markets really liked it, but in terms of it being some, you know, groundbreaking news of information, it wasn't.
No, absolutely. But what was interesting for me was that he basically said, look, we'll have to watch and see what the economic data does ahead before we really do anything, right? Which is a way of saying, well, you know, we're not going to do anything immediately. And it was interesting because a lot of the writers and commentators before Jackson Hole were thinking they were going to set a timetable for tapering, right? But you and I both believe that the tapering conversation is rather misdirected in any case, because we're not sure whether they can ever do it.
Right. Now, I think Powell does not want to taper. And that's my take, is that he really doesn't. And unlike the academics we've had that sit in the Fed chair before, you know, Powell obviously, as we know, comes from the real world, comes from private industry. And he knows that the data is probably transitory and he needs more time. I mean, this is like being in, you know, the fourth quarter of a game and you're trying to run the clock out. You just know that it's going to play out in your favor if you can buy more time. And all these Fed speakers are running around saying, oh, we got to taper. Now, from perspective, which we need to give this, Powell's job is up in a couple months. I mean, so the Biden administration has to make a decision. Will he stay or will he go? Because if he's going to go, they need to not only tell him, but they need to start vetting some new Fed speakers. So there's really nothing lost by some of these other speakers coming out and saying taper, because they know where Powell's at in this situation. And so you start looking at that speech, and the part to me that was more interesting than any part of it was how he had a couple paragraphs about tapering too soon can be a big mistake. And a lot of people misinterpret that as he wasn't talking to you or I, he was talking to the other Fed speakers and saying, look, you're about to embark on a policy mistake that could directly affect me. And of course, he has so much power there. A lot of people look at the FOMC and say, well, Steve, it's a committee. Don't they vote? They do vote. There's only two votes that matter. That's the chair and the vice chair. It doesn't matter if everyone dissented. That's who matters.
Right. And I think that important context about the job application or reapplication, right? That a lot of people have missed that. But for me, it's a pretty important thing.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to look at it. I mean, Powell is a politician. Whether or not you view his job as something he got by vote, obviously from that perspective, he's not a politician, but he's rich. I mean, last I heard, he's worth over $100 million. So his money is not the motivating factor here. But as the Fed chair, he is one of the most powerful people in the world, arguably more powerful than a sitting president, because when the Fed talks, the world stops. I mean, literally everything stops when he has a press conference. That is more powerful than some presidents get. And through monetary policy, he can directly affect the economy and the president's term. So, you know, you look at his situation as he has the money, but he can't buy the power he's got now. So for him, is he going to do things to stay in power? Yeah, I think he's going to. And what is that decision he's got to make? Taper. I mean, not taper, but keep the QE machine running at all costs.
Yeah, Absolutely. Well, you know, I sometimes get asked, why do I focus so much on the US economy, despite the fact that I'm in Australia, right? But you've just made the point exactly why, right? Because frankly, everything around the world hinges on what the Fed does or doesn't do, right? And they really, partly because, of course, the dollar is the anchor, partly because the fact that the Fed is so big and so powerful, and partly, frankly, that all the other central banks watch to see what the Fed is doing and then ape them. So from all sorts of reasons, whatever the Fed is doing is critical to understand because it flows across every Western economy and probably even beyond that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what I think is kind of interesting to kind of take this to the next level is you've seen a lot of other central banks start to taper or talk that, hey, we're going to be cutting our balance sheet purchases back, and the Fed isn't. So there's this weird view that's running around saying, well, if everyone else does, the Fed is going to. And see, I agree with you. The Fed is the leader here. And you have to really understand that, because what is the world want? The world actually needs the US to do more importing, because that is how the system works. How do dollars get to Australia? They don't magically just show up there. I have to travel there. I have to buy something from Australia. I have to spend dollars in their economy, in your economy, and I need to do that. So how do you get American consumers, me, to say, come visit my buddy Martin North in Australia and all my fans there? Well, what do I want as a consumer? I need lower interest rates, right? And I need a stronger dollar. I need that currency to have a reason that I can say, hey, for the same amount of money, I could go and do a trip here in the United States. I could fly to Australia and have, you know, a vacation I'll never forget. And so how do you get a stronger dollar from the central bank's perspective? Well, if the Fed doesn't change and everyone else tapers, you can do that. And that's what's really going on, is the other central bankers realize is there's too much easing going on around the world, and they need to weaken their currency relative to the dollar, or in reverse, we need to have the dollar gain strength. Well, how do you do that? You get everyone else to taper but the Fed.
Yeah, and I always have that view that this is like the last person standing, right? So the others will do stuff. The Fed won't, which, as you say, protects the dollar and positions them very well. Remember that, of course, the mandate of the Fed is to look after the U.S. economy and, you know, the momentum. And that is very much about, well, then what is the dollar going to do, right? And in the current environment with China and, you know, some of the stuff that's going on there, I think that's the point that people again are missing.
Right. I mean, everybody does want a stronger dollar. I mean, China wants it because they want to export here. We're seeing, you know, what I see today, the port of Long Beach has like 44 ships, a record number or near record number. And that's the whole game of having your currency as the world reserve. It greases the global trade cycle. And so what do you need to do? You need your currency not to be super strong. You just need it to be a bit stronger than everyone else. So that way, again, an American consumer or business says, I need to buy this good or service. And someone in another country says, I can do it for less. And that's how the system works. That's how dollars get across the oceans, for example. And China wants that. Everyone else wants it, but they can't directly get the Fed to do things. And we know that. So what do we know about quantitative easing? Does it actually debase the dollar? It does not do that. It does the exact opposite by trapping dollars into the US commercial banking system. So if you understand how quantitative easing works and you're a foreign central bank compared to the US, what would you need to do then to help the Fed? You would want to do less of quantitative easing, so that way the dollar can actually gain some strength. Hopefully not too much, because they don't want too strong, but hopefully to gain a little bit more strength.
And that, of course, then suggests that the quantitative easing programs currently running in the US at $120 billion are likely to continue for some time. Of course, there's a massive amount of liquidity sloshing around the system. The reverse repos are still there. You know, a lot of money is going back from the banks to the central bank. So it's just lifting both sides of the balance sheet. And with interest rates, of course, so low, the costs of that are pretty low. But there was an interesting observation from the House of Lords in the UK. They did a review of quantitative easing in the UK. came out a couple of months ago. And that report basically said, look, it's not really helping the real economy in the UK, but what it is doing is keeping interest rates low, which means that it's down for government debt and the cost of government debt. But there is really no explanation from the Bank of England as to how they can reverse it, how they can get out of quantitative easing, right? And I think that was a very insightful observation, particularly because one of the people who wrote the report was the guy in the UK back in 2008 who started quantitative easing in the UK post the global financial crisis. And he's saying it's gone too far and, you know, the plot's gone in terms of what it's there for. So I'm not sure that many of those other central bankers around the world are going to be in a position to tighten down and back on quantitative easing anytime soon either.
No, I don't think they are. I just think they have to back off a little bit. And that's, again, you know, what is the goal? And it's kind of like a game of, you know, you're juggling. And you've got these balls in the air. And monetary policy is not something you just go take a dial and twist it to where you want and you get the desired outcome. So what do we need? We need a slightly stronger dollar, a little bit stronger than it is now. So how do you do that? Either the Fed has to do more QE, and there's no way politically Powell can get away with that. I mean, there's no way he can come out and say, by the way, conditions are such that we need to do more. Now, he wants to do more. He can't do it now. So what do? You get your buddies just to back off the gas a little bit, just enough to perhaps influence, you know, the currency a bit. And I think they're seeing that. And we've seen the dollar kind of bottoming out relative to other currencies and looking to go higher. So I think it's having some effect there.
Right. And so the DXY, for example, has moved, you know, significantly from where it was previously because of that very, very factor. But what about the bond market? What is the bond market now telling us, Steve?
Yeah, well, we're definitely seeing interest rates starting to head lower. Obviously, that is a byproduct of quantitative easing itself. It's suggesting financial conditions are tightening. We're looking at consumer confidence is starting to roll over. And so you're starting to see some indication. We see it in the lending market where lending growth is still weak. In fact, just looked at the data a moment ago. Total loans and leases in the U.S. commercial banking system are still negative on a year-over-year basis. So the natural direction now for interest rates is they need to come down, which I know is hard. And a lot of people are like, how can they go much lower? But really, the key thing to understand is dollars are created in the commercial banking system when people borrow. And generally, as a rule of thumb, higher interest rates do not entice people to borrow. Now, at some point, they do. But on the onset, higher interest rates would lead to less borrowing. So if you wonder why over the last 40 years, the ball or the playbook of the Fed is lower and lower interest rates, because it spurs credit growth. So right now we're seeing definitely a topping pattern in yields. I'm looking now on the 30-year, a break of 1.9. I think, I don't know if it broke it quite today or was really close, but once we get through 1.8, there's a lot of downward momentum in U.S. Treasury yields. And that will bring the Fed back to the table with more QE for sure.
Right. And of course, we know that Biden is talking about more stimulus in the real economy, although how much of that will end up in the real economy is another interesting observation. But the other interesting thought here is a lot of people were hanging their hat on gold as the value anchor rather than the dollar as the value anchor. But in fact, gold's really gone nowhere, has it?
No. And again, this is a lack of understanding of what QE is. People think that quantitative easing is money printing. They think that, you know, lower interest rates are inflationary, and lower interest rates actually are not inflationary immediately. So you have to pair it with lending data. So when interest rates go down, as we learned from Milton Friedman's research, it's a sign that monetary policy is actually too tight. And I know people are shaking their head going, $120 billion a month, that's too tight. It's too tight. And so what you see with gold then is you have to understand, again, as this dollar prison, as I talk about with quantitative easing, again, it traps dollars in the U.S. commercial banking system and limits their mobility. Now, when you start looking at, there's something like 8 or 12 commercial banks that are really matter. And out of those commercial banks, there's really only two, because only two are taking on a massive amount of deposits from all of this stimulus. So what we then can look at is what's called the velocity of money, or how many times money is exchanging hands or used to purchase goods or services. And we're seeing it's just in the toilet. And so from gold's perspective is everyone thinks that we're printing money, there's all this, and then we're gonna see inflation. So they're looking at the CPI and totally misunderstanding what's going on. The CPI is rising not due to money printing, it's due to supply chain slowdown. So when you start looking at gold, which again, I'm a big fan of, just not in the short term, and you see the dollar set to go higher because of what the Fed is doing and what other central banks are doing, then the natural direction for gold has to be lower. And you start looking at the charts and you see, wow, this huge topping pattern in gold and gold mine stocks and silver, and you start to say, well, is that legitimate? Yeah, I think it is.
And you mentioned the velocity of money. It's interesting because I was going to move absolutely onto that as the next critical thing. It is probably one of the most stunning charts, right? If you look back at the trend over the last years, we'll put the chart on the screen, right? You know, the velocity of money is how long it takes for the dollar to go around the system, right? The higher the velocity, the more activity there is in the system, right? It's as low as it's ever been and is just dragging along the bottom, which suggests that the economy is not doing what people think the economy is doing.
Right. In fact, you know, then the question is, well, why are stocks going up? Well, because people are borrowing their brains out to buy stocks on margin. But yes, you start to look at the velocity of money is telling you everything that we need to know about the U.S. economy. It's not moving at all. It's stuck in, you know, quicksand or mud might be a good analogy in a swamp. It's just not moving anywhere. And the lower the velocity is, well, that means interest rates need to go down in order to get that money moving. And kind of what's interesting that I thought, Martin, was that before the velocity data came out, a lot of people, in fact, in interviews I'd done, said, oh man, you're going to be so wrong. Velocity is going to shoot up. The economy's, you know, is reopening. I'm like, you know, it could happen. But when you really understand QE, if it does pop, it's going to be brief. And literally people were stunned. I was watching them comment on Twitter and I'm like, no one wanted to say that. That was one of the few things I ever get right. But it was like, yeah, when you understand QE, what it means is velocity is actually going to even get worse. And then there you look at interest rates and you start to say, well, there's another argument for downward pressure on rates and the economy heading back into a recession.
Right. And so that suggests then that if I think about stock markets, right, and again today that the markets were pretty strong. I think the Dow didn't quite hit a new record, but, you know, the others did pretty much. That suggests that we're going to see more of the same for a period of time until light dawns. The question is, when will light dawn? And I was reading a couple of commentators yesterday from some of the other investment bankers getting more and more negative in terms of the outlook on the economy and therefore on the markets, and beginning to talk again about, well, maybe things are a bit overvalued. We're in that wobbly, bubbly territory, and we're into September, October, where traditionally if things go wrong, they tend to go wrong then. Interesting times.
Yeah, and it's like, well, what's driving the market? Is it fundamentals? Is it the economy? Is it consumer sentiment? No, it's margin debt. It's passive flows, margin debt, and corporate share buybacks. And the only question is, how long will corporates have money to keep buying their shares back? That will be relative to the consumer spending. How long will banks continue to extend out these margin loans before they pull that back? And just in case anyone's wondering, if you want to go look at peaks in markets, go back and look at the dot-com bubble, and then go look at the great financial crisis, see these big, huge increases in margin debt. And so when people say, well, the market can't go down 40, 50%. Yeah, well, when all this margin debt gets extinguished and people are forced to sell, it can happen. And then of course the last is passive flows. But you know, we've got what is going to be a very interesting situation with the unemployment data. As you know, Martin, September 6th, the federal extended unemployment benefits go away here in the US. A lot of people term out on their state benefits. And so you start to wonder is, are we going to see more job losses follows through as spending goes down, and there goes some of your passive flows that are going into stocks.
Yeah, and that's really the point. Again, you know, those economic indicators will be important, but the route out of this that everyone was expecting in terms of, you know, the tapering coming quickly and then interest rates rising, that's just a fairyland story, right? I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. Once the markets begin to understand that, though, there is a very significant chance, I think, of a change of trajectory. But, you know, the timing is the question, and nobody can perhaps call the timing. But I think going back to when is Powell up for re-election or, you know, renomination or whatever the right term is? Well, a couple of months. So maybe that's a bit of a window as to when things could flip over.
Yeah, and I don't think the Biden administration wants him out. I mean, and maybe they do, but that's politically very hard to do. He's got Janet Yellen's support and some other support from key players. And it's really hard to unseat a Fed chair, as you know. I mean, in good times, you can kind of do it because it doesn't really matter. But it's if you look at Powell's situation, is he doing what the administration and what Congress wants right now? Absolutely. So, you know, other people can go run around and say, oh, we should taper. But in the end of the day, I don't think the Biden administration wants the Fed to taper. They don't want to take that risk. And Powell doesn't either. You know, so a lot of people will say, well, he doesn't want to go down with the ship. So you got to understand, he's got one last bullet in his gun. And that is effectively not just his QE infinity. It's buy literally every last treasury that you can on the planet. He's got that. It worked once. The odds are it will probably work again. So he can then go out and say, look, I did everything. I did everything I could from a monetary perspective. And you know who's going to do? He's going to be like, it's not my fault. It's Congress and the Biden administration. They needed to do more fiscal stimulus. I told them to do more. I did everything I could. So, you know, I'm okay. Don't blame this problem on me. And I think those are cards that he knows he wants to play. In the end, even if things go bad under his watch, if he's reelected to another term, is it going to hurt him? Nah. He'll still walk out of the Fed, as we know, like other Fed chairs, and make more money. Not that he needs it anyway.
Well, that's right. And it goes back to this weird phenomenon that we've got, where effectively we've got a small proportion of people and businesses doing extremely well, but majority of people basically really up against it with, you know, cash flow pressures, with cost of living pressures, with wage growth still not where it should be. And so this sort of really weird situation where you've got this pivoting going on, you know, with small proportion doing well, everybody else not, is the fundamental test to me as to whether this is really a success or whether it's not. And I have to say, on that basis, I don't rate it as a successful strategy.
No. In fact, we're seeing in the, you know, some of the Fed factory survey, we saw the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index today still expanding, but at a much, much slower rate. So we're seeing signs, you know, retail sales rolling over, and we're seeing all kinds of data, crude oil on a year over year basis, which is a great barometer for where the CPI is going. It's headed much lower. So you start looking at all these indicators, and all it's going to take, and we'll have a non-farm payroll report at the end of this week, just, you know, there, all we are is one big miss away from that taper talk going away. And all of a sudden, like you said, market participants going, recovery. No, we're headed the other direction. And, you know, in fact, it's probable that that's going to happen, because you look at the U.S. unemployment data and we should see these numbers dropping. I mean, significantly. We should be seeing like 250,000 people going off the unemployment in back into the payrolls. And we're seeing that, we didn't see that at all. In fact, we're still hovering around 12 million people. It was suggesting that we are due for a big goose egg in non-farm payroll, and the market's not prepared for that at all.
No, absolutely. So it's going to be an interesting time. I suspect volatility will continue. Some market participants love volatility. That's where they make a lot of their money. And it's worth observing that the results season that came through from the banks, a lot of that came through not from real lending, but actually from trading activity, from taking those positions, from using derivatives, and essentially benefiting from the volatility. Again, winners and losers.
Yeah, I love volatility, but most investors don't. That's how you got that right. And yeah, what's going to happen when all of this trading volume goes away? The banks are going to have nothing to show for. They're not doing enough lending. So all of a sudden, their profits and everything are going to go down. I think it's truly going to be interesting to see if the emperor has any clothes or not, because I think you and I know he doesn't, but I think the rest of the world is going to find out sooner than later.
Steve, I always enjoy speaking with you. Thank you very much for sharing your insights, as always. If people want to find out more about you, where do they go?
Oh, really easy. They could just put my name in any search engine. They can find me on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, YouTube, of course, for my YouTube shows as well. Martin, it's always a pleasure coming on your show, and I look forward to it every time.
Thank you very much for your time, and have a great day. And I'm sure we'll pick up the conversation down the track. See you later.
Bye.